Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nachtigall. Just got back from a trip to Israel, and we are packing up our exhibit here, Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered. And here we are in our exhibit space, just returning it back to its original function. However, just before I left, I did get to interview Professor Naama Yahalom Mack up at the very northernmost site, excavation site in Israel at Abel Bet Macha. Really fascinating interview. We're going to play that for you today. This excavation is done by Hebrew University in conjunction with the Israel National Parks Authority and the Israel Antiquities Authority. This is a territory where Israel controlled. It's featured in the biblical narrative during David's time and then a little bit thereafter. I had never visited the site. I was there with my colleague Christopher Reams and even my son. And Naama was very kind to us to give us lots of time while she was excavating with her team. Don't forget, if you like our content, please like and subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also request our magazine. It's called Let the Stone Speak, same name as the podcast. It comes out 6 times per year. It's absolutely free. Wherever you are in the world, if you want a copy of this, you can go to our website, armstronginstitute.org. Or you can write an email to letters at armstronginstitute.org and we'll make sure you get a copy. And so here it is with Professor Naama Yahalom Mack. Thank you very much for taking our interview today.
Thank you, Brent, for visiting us up north.
Yes, this is my first time to your wonderful site at Abel Bet Macha. How would you pronounce that? Is that correct? Or
Abel Bet Macha.
Yes. Macha, great. So how many seasons have you been excavating at this site? Is this a long-term project? And what team do you have assembled this year?
The excavation was initiated by Nava Panitzkoin and Robert Mullins of Azusa Pacific. Nava Panitzkoin is associated with the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and they decided in 2012 to come up here and initiate an excavation. It's one of the largest tells in Israel that was not yet explored.
Okay, how big is it?
It's about 100 dunams, 10 okay. hectares.
Okay.
And both of them are students of Ami Mazar.
Okay.
They came with a very clear methodology and aim. And since this site is located very close to the Lebanese border, it wasn't excavated so far. Bill Deaver surveyed the site back in the 70s, but that's about it.
So that's pretty amazing in terms of archaeological sites that are left untouched.
Exactly. So in 2012, they came up here and surveyed the site. They decided to open some excavation areas in areas around the ancient Arab village that used to be here until 1948 by the name of Abil al-Kamech.
Okay.
So preserving the ancient name of Abel Bet Macha.
Ah, yeah.
Right. I joined the excavation in 2015.
Okay.
Just as an advisor for all kinds of analyses that were done up at the site. And since then, since 2017, I've been affiliated with the Hebrew University.
Okay.
And I'm a co-director of the excavation to this very day.
Fantastic.
So Robert Mullins wasn't able to join us this year, so it's okay. just Nav and I. And we're also short in staff. And basically excavating with our students at the Hebrew University,
mm-hmm.
both Israeli students and international program that we have
okay.
For MA.
For masters, yes.
So they were here all year. They did not escape when the Iranian attacks began, and mm-hmm. They're here with us today.
Great.
Which is exciting.
Well, it does seem you've got a lot of life back here behind us, so the work is going fast on, and you've had 2 weeks already, or one, and one more to go?
One more to go. This is our last day of the second week. We canceled the first week
yes.
with the uncertainty surrounding the war with Iran.
Okay.
Yes.
So in terms of geography,
yeah.
Where is the tell situated in the larger area?
Yeah, we're at the very northern point of the Hula Valley.
Okay.
As you know, the borders of Israel kind of penetrate into Lebanon at this point. It's the finger of the Galilee.
Yep.
So we've got only Metula as north of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are at the same valley where Chatzor is. Chatzor is in the southern, southwestern corner of the Hula Valley. We've got Tel Dan, 6 kilometers to the east.
And we're even slightly north than Tel Dan.
We're a bit north than Tel Dan, not much. Chatzor is 30 kilometers down south, the Phoenician coast, 30 kilometers to the west, around Damascus as the crow flies, about 70 kilometers to the northeast.
And this is this geographic location of the tell, and you mentioned the cross-section that we have with Aram, Phoenicia, yeah. Northern Israel. This is what is fascinating about this
yes,
site.
This is a meeting point. Mm-hmm. It's a border. It's a junction during the Iron Age.
Right.
It's between the expanding, strong Aramean kingdom of Aram Damascus mm-hmm. that basically swallowed every other small Aramean entity in the region. It's between the...
And that was in the 9th century.
That only happens... in the 9th century, yeah. I would say. 10th yeah. century, we're still in a calmer world. Mm-hmm. The Phoenicians, we've got the Tyre expansion in the 9th century, mm-hmm. but Sidon, Tyre, strong cities in the 11th century as well. Mm-hmm. And we've got the Israelite kingdom, which is expanding from its core in the Jezreel Valley, mm-hmm. and of course the rate of this expansion is debated
right.
today.
We'll get to that in
archaeological
a
research.
yeah. So you've got a meeting point of these different powers. Is that and this is your period of main interest in this site relates to the period of the Iron Age rather than before earlier
yeah,
inhabitation.
So, yeah,
but you maybe, do have that here as well.
Maybe we'll take it a step back and
sure.
say that during the third millennium there's a settlement here, early Bronze Age settlement,
okay.
Along other settlements in the valley. Kedesh is a huge city back mm-hmm. then, excavated by our colleagues from the Hebrew University. And during the second millennium we have an urban center built here, a fortified urban center. And this is in line with, it's a bit later than Tel Dan. Tel Dan is fortified earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the Middle Bronze Age II.
Right.
Hatzor.
What would be a general date for that?
1800.
Okay.
And Hatzor is fortified at about the same time. And, of course, Hatzor is a huge city. It's an 80-hectare site.
Massive.
It's enormous. But during the Middle Bronze, still Dan and Abel are fortified cities that live in the orbit of Hatzor.
Right.
And it's interesting, you know, how the sites are related to one another. But we know that in the end of the Middle Bronze Age, there's a massive destruction of mm-hmm. these urban centers. And both Dan and Abel, they're not really rebuilt. Mm-hmm. They have some late bronze. It's limited in scale. Mm-hmm. At Tel Dan, we've got the famous Mycenaean tomb, so it kind of distorts the picture because, of course, there's some elites around, but it's not a major city. And here as well, our surveys headed by Ido Wachtel, who's a really good specialist of surveys, in 2020 showed that Late Bronze Age is barely existing on this mound. Mm-hmm. Contrary to what we thought or my colleagues thought earlier in the excavations, because we have some activities near the fortifications in the south, but they're very limited. And we do know that at the top of the mound, there is some occupation during the Late Bronze Age, probably dated to the 13th century.
Okay.
So later in the Late Bronze Age, something is built on top of this mound.
And then something happens at the site.
So,
soon thereafter.
Yeah, so what we know is that the entire site is settled during the early Iron Age.
Okay.
And it begins with a pit settlement.
Okay.
A settlement or a village settlement or some kind of an occupation that it's characterized by multiple pits that they're quarrying.
Okay.
It's a known phenomena for the beginning of the Iron One.
Okay.
And we know it to Tel Dan and we know it elsewhere.
Yep.
And then not... much later, we see a rebuilding of the site, and we have public buildings that we excavated at the very bottom of our considerable Iron Age trench here. We are in Area A, that's mm-hmm. in the center of the mound,
okay.
and this is one of the most complete sequences of Iron Age between 12th and 9th centuries that we have, I don't know, anywhere.
Almost anywhere.
It's a really good stratigraphical sequence.
So in terms, just so that people that are watching this can kind of hook it into biblical narrative, at least the time period of the Bible, Once we get to this Iron One period where you're starting to find settlement here and then a larger Iron One structure, we'll talk about what would be some of the dates or personalities that people would think could be related to that.
It's a very good question. It's a time, let's say, we don't know how much after the destruction of Hazor this happens,
right.
But we do identify newcomers that are excavating these pits. So exactly who they are.
So what you're saying is you don't have a ethnic identity that's attached. This people came here and dug here, but this is somewhere in the judges period.
Well, the only thing that we could say is that during the second millennium, Abel is mentioned as Abel or Abilu in the in texts and sources, mainly Egyptian sources.
Okay.
And then when we come to the Bible, suddenly it's Abel Bet Ma'acha.
Okay.
So there is a suffix that it was suggested that the suffix means that newcomers are in play here. But we do see some continuity of the late Bronze Age material culture.
Right.
It's not a strict change.
Absolutely.
We're not talking about ethnicities. We're talking about complex identities here.
And so the earliest mention of the town in the Bible would date from around
from
what
the time of David.
From the time of David.
Let's separate two things. There's the kingdom of Ma'acha, which with its sister kingdom Geshur.
Geshur.
And that's a story that we're not sure how to relate to what's going on here. Excuse me.
Because Ma'acha is a name that's attached to
Ma'acha is a name that we find in the Bible since the days of Genesis. Okay. It's a name. But the kingdom of Ma'acha and Geshur are thought to have existed a little more to the east.
Okay.
Ma'acha should be located in the Bashan or the Golan.
Okay.
And it's not clear why we should consider this, because it was. Some scholars see this as the capital of the kingdom of Ma'acha. In any event, the earliest name of Mamash, you know, Abel Bet Ma'acha in the Bible is from the time of David. With the story of the wise woman, we have the rebel, Sheba ben Bichri. He escapes from Jerusalem all the way to
during
the
Absalom,
north.
Just after Absalom's revolt.
Exactly. And he reaches as far as he can, almost to the very north, because we'll see that there's Ayun, another city to the north mentioned in the campaigns of later kings. He escapes here, and then Job pursues him, and there's a very interesting discussion with a woman that is defined as the wise woman.
The wise woman.
Wise woman of Abel Bet Ma'acha.
And as far as the narrative goes, Sheba, his head is lopped off.
He's beheaded, and the head is thrown over the wall, and
Joab goes back to Jerusalem.
Exactly. So,
do you have habitation from around that time?
Okay, so I want to say that, first of all, not even considering the historicity of this passage, the conversation that the wise woman has with Job is very interesting to us, because she tells him, we are I don't remember the exact words, we are the faithful and the righteous, we believe in the God of Israel, and why are you trying to kill, not to destroy? It's translated in English to destroy. In Hebrew, it's the verb lehamit. Why are you trying to kill a city and a mother in Israel?
Okay.
So what we learn from this text, first of all, is that these people, whenever it is in time, they're situated at a very far away, distant location, and they need to prove that they belong. And this is very interesting for the question of the identity of the people living here. What is their material culture? How is it affected by the Aramean to the north, by the Phoenicians? How Israelite are they, if they are, and when they are?
Right.
You know? And it's a very interesting question to us, and this is one of our major focuses in this excavation, is kind of to try and see this complex identity problem in this border region. And maybe it's easier to talk about who they're paying their taxes to.
Okay.
That's a simpler question, I would say.
Right, rather than the ethnic.
Than talking about what they are in terms of religion, faith.
Right. And so as far as the structures that we have here, that are behind us, what you're excavating right now, maybe we can jump across to the two main phases that we can see, or two main periods that we can see here, Iron One and then Iron Two. What does this area look like during the Iron One period?
So in the Iron One, we've got a gradual development. After the pit settlement, there's some public buildings, very interesting public buildings that are built. And these are a combination between cult and production. We've got multiple matzevot, standing stones, and other cultic features that are together with a lot of production remains, such as grinding stones and ash installations and all kinds of things. So it's something different than what we knew in the Bronze Age. Some kind of development in the
There's industry going on here, religious practices.
And then this is destroyed too in the middle of the 11th century. We've got radiocarbon dates placing the destruction within the 11th century.
Okay.
We have a very similar destruction in Tel Dan.
Okay.
In Tel Dan at the time, the there is a village, a lot of bronze working.
Okay.
So no public buildings. And we are thinking that in the seesaw relationship between the sites, Abel is the major site, Dan would be secondary, and Chatzor practically non-existent during the Iron One.
Okay.
And so this is the time for Abel Bet Malcha to thrive,
to shine.
The 11th century. So after the destruction of those buildings, we have the building here of an elaborate building, very lavish.
You were calling it, kind of calling it a palace.
I want to call it a palace. I don't want to need to excuse myself anymore.
Don't.
I think it's a palace. It's built beautifully.
Walls. Yeah, we saw some of the construction of the walls, the doorways.
This was hit probably by a seismic activity, but all the other walls you can see are really nicely, you know, angled. And the door frames are invested. They're all in the corner of the rooms. They have nice frames with flat stones. And we have these basalt floors. So like in an
interlocking or?
Yeah, like one room with the floor of stones.
Alternating.
One room with stone floor, and then one without, and then one with, and one without.
It's planning.
And one with. And when we started to appreciate this building, we understood that this building needs, we need a plan. We need to know the full plan of this building. And as much as we've expanded, and we've removed a lot of the Iron 2A remains to get down to this building, we still do not know its full plan. It's going on and on and on. And there's a major destruction at the end of this, or the end of this period, which is a very similar destruction to what we know in Megiddo. You know, the Megiddo 6A destruction, Yokneam destruction, Kinneret. This is the time where many sites are destroyed.
And those other sites, do they? We have a culprit behind the destruction of those other sites.
Well, that's a major question in the archaeology of Israel, as well as the question: when were the cities that follow built? Were they built immediately on top of the destruction? Was there a period of a gap? The minimalists like to, you know, expand this gap between the destruction of the Iron One and the building of the Iron Two buildings, and kind of push it down as far as the 9th century, the Omarides, whoever.
But you don't really see that here in the material
here
culture.
Here we see the opposite. We do see them building immediately on top of the, destruction. We see them utilizing walls.
The walls are in the same orientation.
And the walls are built in the same orientation, and it is a different construction. It's a different character. But we do see some continuity between the phases. And this is, again, one of the questions that we're pursuing here.
So in terms of the dating of this, there's always going to be wiggle room. But as you would see the evidence coming in, best as you could describe it, this transition from the destruction of the Iron One city to the construction of the new Iron Two A city, when would your ballpark be for that as far as the information is?
The answer is I do not know.
Well, it wasn't the 12th century and it wasn't the 8th century. So you've got a window that you're working in. That's all I'm...
My window is the 10th century.
Okay.
This is when it happens. And the reason that I know this is because we have excavated a huge citadel in the upper mound of this site, which we date again to the Iron 2A.
Right.
And below the citadel and the foundations of the citadel, we have dates from the late 10th century.
Okay.
So the destruction here, it's a good question. How, if we, first of all, if our dates are really the earliest dates of the citadel, this is difficult to say. We think that they're early, but the destruction here, when you look at the radiocarbon date, there are two peaks, you know,
right.
one in the first half of the 10th century, one in the second half of the 10th century. We're saying that there's not a big gap between them. We need to, of course, prove this. But still, we think somewhere in the beginning of the second half of the 10th century would be a good date for, for the destruction and the rebuilding.
So if we could talk a little bit about the some of the major discoveries that you've made here that have made headlines over the past few years. If we could talk about the head first, the head made out of faience. I don't know if you're sick of talking about this or not, but it's a prize discovery.
No, I'm happy to talk about it, but I'm also sorry to disappoint. A lot of people are trying to bring a face, a person, you know, behind this face.
This is natural.
Of course it's natural, and I fully understand this. We have published this figurine. And,
well, maybe you can just describe the figurine first, and its dating, and then...
Yeah, so first of all, we found it in the latest phase of the citadel up in Area B. We think that it's found in a cultic room.
Okay.
We have a very massive entrance to this chamber. It's one of the casemates, one of the chambers of the casemate. There's a massive entrance. In front of the entrance, there's a circle of stones and an ash besides it. And this guy was found on that floor in this room. He was lying facing up. It's so funny.
Imagine
like
finding...
he wanted people to take me out of here. And when we brought him back to the lab, Mimi Lavia, our conservator, she cleaned him up. And he was absolutely exquisite.
Yeah.
I mean, it's workmanship that we don't see everywhere. He is a bearded male, the head of a bearded male. He has a lot of hair.
Right.
And very black, which means something.
Black hair.
He has black hair, black eyebrows, black pupils, black beard. He's very black, you know. Debbie Ben-Ami, who worked with us on the interpretation of his iconography, says it's a very manly thing to do. If you want to be a man in the ancient Near East, you want to have a lot of black hair.
Oh, no.
That's your...
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm out.
You're out. Sorry. And he's wearing this bandana on his head.
Yeah.
This is a typical Semite type of headdress, you know, for a male. But we have to say that in the stripes, we see yellow.
Okay.
And the yellow is probably indicating gold.
And indicating what?
Gold.
Gold. Okay.
So we're thinking that this guy is an elite. Who is this guy?
When would you date him to?
So that's from the abandonment of the citadel, which is the second half of the 9th century.
Okay.
The entire site was abandoned at the second half of the 9th century. He is maybe representing someone. Someone who placed him on his behalf in this cultic place, to stand before the god permanently, even when he's busy.
Okay.
So it kind of comes to represent this elite person or governor or whoever he is, and not necessarily to depict some, you know, one of the kings as was hypothesized by many journalists all over the world. He got headlines, you know, Ahab and
even without the designation, the artifact itself is so unique and beautiful. And
it is beautiful, and it is made of faience, which is like an early form of glass. It was made in a mold. We've done some research about it. We did a head scan.
Oh yeah.
The head got a head scan in the Weizmann Institute, and we could see the technique, the way that he was pressed into a mold, and the way that things broke when they removed him from the mold. And the materials that were used, for example, the manganese that was used for the black features, and the green that was used for the faience itself, which are probably copper minerals. And
nice.
Yep, it's still one of our prized finds. Today it's in the Israel Museum, rotating.
I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen it there. The other discovery, I think, that was very important, and it portends to the other big question about who the people here were paying their taxes to.
Yeah.
This was an inscription that was found on a storage vessel. I believe it was a storage vessel.
Yes.
What did it say, and what are some of the thoughts that can come from
it? We'll start from the beginning. We opened another area of excavations to the south of this area, in an area which seems like a little bit like a, how do you say,
depression.
A depression. Mm-hmm. We thought that this is a good place for an entrance to the city, maybe a gate or whatnot. And we opened an area of excavation, and we came down on this storage building.
Mm-hmm.
A really nicely built storage building, which seems to have one phase. We excavated, it's defined by a long, long wall on the east, and then walls going perpendicular, mm-hmm. and created these elongated holes. The holes were full of jars.
Amazing.
So this was a storage building for sure.
Absolutely.
We know that they were burnt. It was a sort of a destruction. Not all of them showed fire, but Yoav Vaknin, who does our paleomagnetic research, told us that the vases themselves are burnt.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no dates from this building. We don't know when it was built. One date, one radiocarbon date from below the building tells us that it was built during the 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a 10th century thing. It's a 9th century mm-hmm. Endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's we've already excavated more than 60 jars. We've excavated more than 70. We've restored more than 60. One of them had this inscription below the handle with ink.
Mm-hmm.
And it said Le Benayo, meaning belonging, Le, mm-hmm. belonging, to a guy named Benayo.
Mm-hmm.
And Benayo is a form of a name which is shortened. If he was in Judah, he would have been Benayahu.
Benayahu. Benaniah in the English, if that's how it would be. Just so people can understand.
Okay, and then in the Kingdom of Israel, it would have been shortened.
Mm-hmm.
This diphthong would have been shortened to Benayo. Right,
the
so
it, yep.
The name Bana, to build, God has built, is very mm-hmm. Scarce. Common. You find it everywhere, even in the Aramean sphere, and everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But the ending Yo or Yahu, of course, is the ending of the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're reading it correctly, it's a Hebrew name, Israelite name, with a theophoric ending
mm-hmm.
in an Israelite form.
Mm-hmm.
And Rolston, who was our epigrapher,
mm-hmm. Christopher Rolston,
identified the script as Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, it's important as well to date this building.
Right.
So one name on one vessel doesn't make this an Israelite building. But it is something that is very... planned.
Mm-hmm.
It's planned. And it's administrative.
The building itself.
It's part of some kind of central administration.
Right.
It's not one building. It's probably three buildings mm-hmm. as we stand today. A second one, definitely. Maybe a third, even, to the south. The jars are marked on their handles. About a third of the jars are marked.
Mm-hmm.
The vessels were examined by Anat Cohen Weinberger. She showed that they're local production.
Okay.
So, you know, they're producing the jars. They're probably collecting whatever it is. We still don't know. Probably wine.
Okay.
And maybe this jar was, I don't know, they're all keeping it to someone from the Israelite sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was built by a central administration that was Israel at mm-hmm. the time. So if you force me into the corner,
which I would force you into the corner. So that's good. You're doing it yourself.
I'm doing it myself because I know what's coming. I would say that maybe this is where the Omerites come in.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a building activity here from the 10th century, but the Omerites would be
responsible for
would
that
be responsible century. For some makeover during in the middle of the 9th century.
Right.
I don't think this storehouse lived long. Mm-hmm. I think it was short-lived, and it was it was abandoned or destroyed not much later, and probably during the time of this Armenian destruction.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in people that excavate the site having the first dibs at being the one to give forth their interpretation of the site rather than other people interpreting
for them.
But this period is very debated in archaeological circles. How far did the Kingdom of Israel come towards the north? People have different theories of when the northward expansion happened. And many of the minimalists would put that as far as the mid-8th century, even when Israelite domination came underneath Jeroboam II.
Right.
But from what you're doing here, you seem like that is pretty late.
So if we want to be careful, we would say that our excavations, first and foremost, put Abel Bet Maacha on the map during the 10th century and the 9th century.
Right.
If you look at the Forgotten Kingdom of Israel Finkelstein's 2013 book, you'll see Abel Bet Maacha is not even there. It's not on the map during the time of the 10th century,
okay.
nor in the time of the 9th century.
And yet that's when you had the biggest...
Exactly. And only in the time of Jeroboam II, the 8th century, Abel Bet Maacha is placed there along with Dan.
Mm-hmm.
But we see a very different picture from our excavations here. Abel Bet Maacha was thriving during the 9th and even before, late 10th century.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it was Israelite to begin with or whether it was annexed during the time of the Omerites, it still remains a question, but it was there. The 8th century rather is missing here.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have the Tiglath-Pileser destruction here.
Okay.
We have it at Dan.
Yep.
We have it at Hazor. We do not have it here. It seems like we have lost ground and other sites regained. So it's a bit of a seesaw effect, maybe between us and Dan.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Dan is highly debated today. According to the Bible, it's a religious center from the time of Jeroboam I.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only... what we see here, if we can do the comparisons and relate our finds to Tel Dan, and we're trying to do that as we speak, there's no reason to suspect that Dan is not existing at this time. It could be a modest settlement. It doesn't mean that it's not a cultic center. The biblical narrative generally falls in place with our excavations here at the Abel Bet Maacha in the region, I would say.
So we talked briefly about the faience head. We talked about the inscription. You also found a large vessel full of bones.
Well, that's true. But, you know, we're kind of focusing on the anomalies and not saying anything about the larger assemblage here.
Great. Please do that.
And I have to say that we have pottery here that includes the red burnished pottery that we know from the Israelite territory. Of course, it's also found to the northern, in the north, so it could reach here. And we've got a hippo jar here. We've got vessels that are in line, and generally the material culture.
So hippo jar, why is that significant? Just for...
So, you have multiple hippo jars in the Jezreel Valley. This is like the economic system of the Jezreel Valley.
Okay.
And this is one reason why some researchers would like to leave the Chula Valley out of the Israelite kingdom, assuming that the hippos kind of define the boundaries of Israel at some point. Of course, it's not necessarily so. It's an economic system, and there are other economic systems to the north. We've got our K-jars that form a different economic system, and it doesn't mean, I don't think it means anything about geopolitics.
Right.
But we do have material culture, which is very diverse here. It could be recognized in sites to the south. It could also be recognized in sites to the north. It includes...
By north, you mean Phoenicia?
I mean Phoenicia and the few sites in Lebanon that we know a little bit their material culture.
Mm-hmm.
We have some elements that are koine, that are shared shared material culture between the peoples of the area. And it doesn't mean, doesn't matter if they're, if you want to define them as Phoenician or Armenian or whatever. Otherwise, we do have things that correlate with the material culture of the Kingdom of Israel. So we have both.
How much do you have that would correlate with Aram Damascus here, material culture that you would say?
We don't know the material culture of Aram Damascus. Well, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
And generally, Arameans, it's not always easy to define what it is exactly. You know, it's exactly not the case of pots and people. The Armenians are dispersed. They come into existing settlements and they kind of sink in there. And we really tried in the beginning of the excavation. It was a major theme. You know, that this would shed light on the Armenian material culture, but it didn't. I mean, as far as we know. So again, we've got elements that are work well with the Israelite kingdom to the south. We also have elements that are a sort of koine, shared material culture. Yes, and the astragaly jar is an interesting find because the Arntu'e remains are really monumental. These are large building, and there's a lot of industry. We've got a pottery kiln and many taboons and a lot of giant walls. They're very difficult to remove, I have to say. And as part of one of these giant buildings was a stone pavement. On top of the stone pavement was a jar. Inside the jar was kind of elevated. There was a circle of stones, and the jar was situated on top of it. It was full of astragaly bones. That's the knuckle bones of the hind leg of a, an animal.
Okay.
And we had 406 smashed in one jar. And these were analyzed by Matt Sasnow, really studied every single one of them. And he could show that it wasn't 200 animals slaughtered for this event. It was collected over time, and they were used. They had some of them were perforated, some of them. And it seemed like someone collected them together at this time, which is the end of the occupation here, the very late, the very final phase.
This is mid-9th century?
That would be second half of the 9th century. I can't really say exactly when. And collected them in this jar. And whatever happened there, we don't know. We just know that in many cultures, these bones are used for divination. The other possibility is a game, but this is not a game. They left it there standing, full of astragaly. So if there was kind of a ceremony, it was, the result was the abandonment of the site. That's a dramatic find, I think.
So that's happening mid to late or mid to second half of the 9th century. And then you said you don't have the destruction of Tiglath-Pileser at all, and that's mid-8th century. So what happens in that 100 years? So these buildings continue to be used? Sites abandoned?
We think there is actually a long period of abandonment. We do find some remains in the very late 7th century.
Okay.
And we do have a beautiful Assyrian cylinder seal, which may be dated based on its iconography to the Assyrian period. And we do have a few walls here and there that are later than all this Iron Age II constructions.
So just finally, in terms of modern-day geopolitics, this group that you have here, you said it was 1 week delayed from when you could start the excavations. When we were walking up the Tell, we can see the demilitarized zone with Lebanon. But you said you actually felt a little bit safer now.
Well, in hindsight, you know, we are situated here, and there was Hezbollah outposts on top of the village to the west and on top of this demilitarized hill to the east, and they were watching us.
This was like for the past 10 years.
10 years. We were at gunpoint. And we knew that they were there, and we were excavating here, and not knowing what the future entails and what they were thinking about. And once this threat was removed, I think we're safer here than we ever were to dig here. So
you're back digging.
Even with the events in Syria and the Druze everything that happened, which is very close by, we did not feel that happening. We did not hear almost anything. Mm-hmm. And the army is watching over us. We inform them every day that we're going up the tell.
Okay.
We let them know that we're leaving the tell. And they're watching over us. We know. They're looking over our shoulders. So.
Well, thank you very much for touring us around the site and bringing our viewers as well along with you. Thanks for your efforts over the past decade. 10-year anniversary for you, at least, being up here on the site. How many more seasons do you think it'll tick on?
Well,
too much until you find the rest of this building here behind us.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Sure.
Thanks very much to Professor Nama Yalamak for that interview. Such a wonderful site. You can look forward to an upcoming transcript of the interview in Let the Stone Speak, our magazine that comes out 6 times per year. That's free for you. If you so desire, go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and you can scroll down and find a place where you can register to receive the magazine for free. Again, 6 times per year, wherever you are in the world. And then finally, if you like our content on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe. I'll see you next time.